in association with iFanboy. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Okay, we all know that Obama caught Osama, and in doing so, I think he knocked off a good comic book story off a lot of conservative websites and newspapers, namely that Superman has renounced his U.S. citizenship in Action 900. David Goyer wrote that short story, and it was probably done with very little concern, but then it became red meat for a day on Friday. Thankfully, the rest of the world worried about bigger things, and it seems to have come off the front page. We're talking about Superman today, and yes, we'll mention Action Comics 900, but more importantly, we're talking about the DC Retroactive books that are coming out this summer. We're talking also with Marty Pascal. Marty was a writer for DC in the 70s and 80s, took a brief time off to do a lot of great television shows like Roseanne, Simon & Simon, and others, also a lot of animation work. Marty came back to DC in the late 80s for some comic book writing, but also to be the liaison between DC Comics and the other divisions of Warner Brothers. Today we talk a lot of Superman with Marty. He shares reflections and observations of former Superman cast members from the films and the various TV series. We also get a good look at how DC Comics worked in the 70s. The discussion covers a lot of areas that I think fans have had questions about. Why doesn't the company work a certain way? And inadvertently, Marty just gives us a good perspective on answering those questions. Why? It's another interesting discussion, and we're glad to bring it to you here on Word Balloon. Let me just say, it's great having you back. I'm sorry it's been so long.
Oh, it's great to be back. The feedback I got from the last ones that I did with you was really terrific.
Well, that's fantastic, man. And you've certainly been busy. And I'm glad that one of the things we wanted to talk about was the new DC Retroactive book you got coming out this summer, because Superman has been all over the place in the headlines.
We're all about Superman this week, aren't we?
First, let's unfortunately acknowledge the passing of the great Perry White of the Christopher Reeve films, Jackie Cooper.
Yes.
I happen to see on Facebook that you spent some time with him in one of his many roles in Hollywood as a TV director. Tell us about that.
That's right. Jackie was an old friend of John Stevens, who was the executive producer on Simon & Simon when I was a story editor there. Phil Daguerre had gone on to do other things, the creator of the show. But I found out from a number of people, you know, that he was a really good director, and we had been a little bit frustrated with the people that we had up to that point. And Jackie was famous for pissing off the crew because he knew how to do everybody's job better than they did. He'd been in the business for so long, and he wasn't pushy about it. He wasn't, he just would show up and say, all right, that's it. He would point to the lighting instrument and go, that's in the wrong place. Move that over here. Take this, do that. And that was his reputation for about 20 years of directing at that point in television. In fact, Alan Alda used to get frustrated with him, and he tells that story in his book. But it's true that he really did know other people's jobs. I had done a rewrite on the script that he was directing. And I'm sitting in the projection room where we're looking at dailies, and I hear him behind me giving an instruction to the editor, saying, okay, now back this in. You know, you have just about all this complicated stuff, but he's quoting the script. He's saying, now when AJ says this, that's when you have to bring in the car to do that. And then later he says, blah, 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 and he's quoting the script. And of course, because I'd done the rewrite, I knew the dialogue. I turn around and look at him. He doesn't have a script in his lap. He has memorized the entire thing, and he's quoting it verbatim from memory.
Wow.
And I suspect that when he did Perry White, I didn't have the opportunity to discuss the Superman movie with him, because Simon & Simon was kind of an old-fashioned set where, you know, when you would show up there, you would hear the crew say to each other, writer on the set, writer on the set, which is code for don't badmouth the script, you'll embarrass us. So whenever I dealt with him, it was strictly business. But what I do know from another friend who had been working with Keenan Wynn on what turned out to be his last film.
Wow.
Sidney Lumet's Just Tell Me What You Want. That Wynn was in failing health, and he had gotten to the point where he just couldn't do anything anymore. You might remember that Keenan Wynn was originally cast as Perry White. And what had happened is his daughter would have to show up on the set and literally point him in the direction of who was speaking to him, because he could not hear. He was totally deaf.
Wow.
And that was why the Salkins at the last minute recast Perry White. And I remember all of us at DC at the time, because I was working on the books when the movie was being made.
Sure.
We're wondering, Jackie Cooper, because that wasn't anybody's idea of Perry White.
But you can, you can see the bluster coming from Keenan Wynn. And for, you know, younger listeners who might not know, Keenan Wynn, if you go back to those old Disney movies like The Absent-Minded Professor, he was the, and Son of Flubber, for example, he was kind of the bad guy in those. He made that great Twilight Zone where he's the writer and he speaks into his tape recorder and basically can change reality. So,
right, but at this time he was well into his 70s.
Sure.
And was just couldn't do it. And I think what happened was Cooper was the one person that they could find who was willing, able to do it, get on a plane, and was a quick enough study. I'll bet that they didn't have any problems with him whatsoever. And I remember hearing that he was a great joy to work with and that he did save the Salkin's butt on that picture. But then again, I've always had, you know, issues with the people in the futures who've been cast as Perry White. I mean,
interesting.
Frank Langella is a wonderful actor, but where they got that one from, I don't know.
You know, that's interesting because, I mean, I agree. It didn't stand out the way, and I'm blanking on his name, but J.K. Simmons did such a great job as J. Jonah Jameson, for example, in the Spider-Man movies.
Right.
But
well,
he's just
a wonderful actor, period.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's the thing. I felt that, and certainly in the case of Cooper, it brought his own charm. It wasn't the typical Perry White, but it worked. But then even in Langella's role, I thought it, you know, he was able and capable, and I thought it was, you know, good enough. But that's interesting. I appreciate your disapproval. Who would you see as Perry White?
Now,
yeah,
I could tell you who I'm hoping they'll cast, because of the pre-existing relationship with Chris Nolan. I'd love to see Tom Wilkinson do it.
Oh, that's interesting.
It depends on how the script is written. I don't know anything about the script. I don't know whether it's a large enough part for him. But I mean, Wilkinson does an extraordinary American accent.
True.
And I mean, I've loved him in just about everything I've seen him in. George Clooney picture. So it's a guy's name, and I'm blanking on it now.
Oh yeah, Michael Clayton.
Michael Clayton, right? Exactly. You know, he Carmine Falcone in the original Nolan Batman picture.
Yeah, Batman Begins.
We'll
absolutely. No, you know, I even liked him as Joe Kennedy, and I watched the Kennedy's miniseries. Well, the parent company just bought our radio station, so we had a vested interest to see how the Kennedy's miniseries was.
Well, I mean, I enjoyed watching him work, but the script sort of fought back a little bit on that one.
Oh yeah, I know what you mean. Absolutely. Well, and that's really amazing. And you know, really, like you said, it's especially to come in at last minute. He really did bring his own persona to the role and had some great lines. And really, even in the two, more so in Superman 4, it's so funny. My friends and I kind of rewatched Superman 4 recently. And exactly, just to kind of see. And Art Balthasar, the co-creator of Tiny Titans, is a big defender of Superman 4. He agrees it's a bad movie. But what he likes to point out is how much it runs like a Julie Schwartz edited Superman story. And I kind of see that.
I wish you hadn't said that.
Well, but just in terms of the problem solving and also, again, I really think Jackie had some good moments in there. You know, just with the lotto game that he has to put on in the front page and that he's bummed that the guy is buying out his newspaper and everything. I think Jackie had some good moments in that movie, actually.
I got to be honest. That's the one I have never been able to get through. I get about as far as John Cryer showing up and that's it. I'm out of there. You know,
I do know.
All I got to say, you know, is, I mean, I think Cryer's a really fine actor and he's been given some wonderful opportunities. And I think nobody deserves Charlie Sheen.
Understood.
But it looks like he may end up being the winner in that one.
Yeah, that's another weird situation. Well, let's get back to Superman because this,
you know me, I'll go anywhere you go, John. So you take charge.
All right, you're a good man. Well, I am curious. Did you read Action 900? Have you read this David Goyer story that inadvertently caused this ridiculous flap?
No.
Okay.
And for a very specific reason. Again, not to plug so much, but the retroactive book that I'm writing, even as we speak, is, I guess I don't want to say I misunderstood the conceit, but I was, as I have a tendency sometimes to do, overstated the goal. And I was trying very, very hard to mimic how I wrote the book, the Superman books 40 years ago.
Okay.
Did I actually let myself say that? And it was a much, much harder task, and it still is a much harder task than I expected. because I don't write that way anymore, and I haven't, you know, I haven't in years. A lot of that was a style evolved, and it's coming back to me as I'm constantly rereading this stuff, trying to capture that tone and that style. It was a style that was evolved to get past Julie Schwartz. Julie had a number of conventions about, or conventional ideas, I should say, about how comics should be written. And if you didn't want him rewriting your copy, some of my older colleagues from that era, you know, have been on my case lately for misinterpreting some remarks I've made elsewhere about bad-mouthing Julie Schwartz. I just want to make it very, very clear. Julie Schwartz was a father to me in this business. Julie Schwartz planted the idea of being a writer in my head. And I would never want to do or say anything to dishonor his memory. But truth is truth. And I also believe I have a responsibility I move into the elder statesman's position in the business, a role I'm not comfortable with, but it keeps being thrown on me by projects like this. I feel I have an obligation to the oral history. I mean, it's because it's a relatively new phenomenon that people are actually documenting, you know, the comic book industry.
Absolutely.
There is so much controversy now around the efforts to do that. And particularly when you're talking about the home of Superman, because of the litigation and the various issues that just won't go away.
Indeed.
There's a lot of dispute about what happened and who said what and who did what, because nobody was nobody was keeping records. So I had to, when I was, for example, doing the DC Vault project, I had to double check with as many people as I could get in touch with who had been present at the creation about the accuracy of some of the things that, for example, Jerry Jones said in Men of Tomorrow, which I think is a magnificent, brilliant book. I feel now that because there hasn't been much of an oral history and we're sort of scratching our heads about a lot of stuff, that I think going forward, there are still some things that haven't really been put on the record that I think people of my generation in the business, if you will, those of us who have a good relationship with DC but are not on DC's payroll per se.
Sure.
Can feel free, you know, to talk about without necessarily jeopardizing that relationship. And one of them is that Julie was a fairly heavy-handed editor. He was a frustrated writer in a lot of ways, but he also knew that he couldn't write. And when you earned his trust, you got to the point where you could say to him, look, Julie, you say you can't write. Then it's in my best interest to get to the point where you won't rewrite me. And he said he couldn't argue with that logic. So we got to the point in the relationship where rather than him taking a pencil to the stuff, I'd do the rewrite. I'd do a rewrite. If I got far enough ahead, I could take it back with me. I usually would do it in the office. I'd sit there waiting for him to read it, and then, you know, this doesn't work for me or whatever. And that was an excellent learning curve. It gave me a tremendous insight into the way he thought, and he got to the point where he was open to my pushback, which was, Julie, that's not really contemporary. That's not the way we structure stories in comics anymore. That's certainly not the way Marvel structures story. And they're starting to eat DC's lunch, so now we have to be thinking in terms. We have to be thinking in terms of coming at stuff structurally differently. And that was when I started in the books doing a lot of things with running subplots, story arcs that would go sometimes as long as six issues. It was as different from what Julie was used to as possible, and I paved the way I like to think for Len Wein, who followed me, and whom Julie trusted a lot more. I had a longer history with. To go further in that direction, just as Jerry Conway, preceding me on Superman, had opened Julie's mind to, you know, a number of things. But because of those subplots running over several issues, well, it's one of the things I'm finding very, very difficult about doing this story, is it's a self-contained story.
Certainly.
So I'm trying to capture a flavor of something that came from structure more than anything else. Now, I'm not ducking your question about Action 900.
No, not at all. This is all good, but go ahead.
The reason I'm behind in my Superman reading, I guess is the best way to say it, because I've deliberately been staying away from reading how they're treating the character now. I'm enormously fond of a lot of the stuff that they've done. I mean, I read a lot of the recent material and some stuff that had not yet come out when I was doing the Superman Encyclopedia with Bob Greenberger.
Yes.
And I thought the new Krypton storyline, even though I think the fans felt it didn't, I gather from what I read in the message boards, that it ultimately was an anticlimax, shall we say, because it didn't really, as I understand, seriously impact the continuity. But as I say, I'm really behind in the reading because I will become a sponge and I will start writing this project that is supposed to evoke a particular era in a more contemporary style.
Understood.
And I'm having a hard enough time as it is, as I say, capturing that. The other thing is tone. This is a lighthearted story. This is a whimsical story. We used to do those in Superman.
Sure.
And that, I think, is one of the ways. I pitched to Ben Abernathy, the editor, going in that direction for one very simple reason. What better way to communicate the flavor of an era than by doing a type of story in terms of tone that just isn't done anymore?
True.
Now, that's going to be a kind of a risky thing, but there's no guarantee that the younger readers will even pick this stuff up anyway. I mean, as DC itself has publicized, Dan DiDio took a poll at WonderCon when they announced the project, and a head count of people in the room, and I understand that the median age of the people who were interested in this project was something like 50. So.
Understood, man, and I'm only a couple years shy of that, and I felt the same way when they've announced some of these teams, so I understand what you're saying.
But what I'm getting at is this project was a suggestion from the marketing department, and I think they're finally understanding that there is an exploitable audience of people who have a kind of nostalgia. You know, I mean, I'm trying to flip it and put myself in the mindset of some of the younger readers. I don't know. And I can't honestly say, if Gardner Fox were still alive when I was first starting to write comics, would I be interested in seeing something new from Gardner Fox? You know, it doesn't all work, but I would be curious to know, and there's no way I can get this information, but I would be curious to know what the numbers were on didn't DC actually release the Bob Haney Teen Titans script?
Yes, they did.
He wrote, they actually did that?
Yes, they did. So you read that script, obviously. You know that story.
I read the script. I didn't.
Sure.
So I don't know. I don't know how much it was massaged.
Well, I mean, it certainly had that Bob Haney goofiness. I mean, certainly was, JFK alive and well on the other side of the galaxy as a space hero. So that was kind of fun. And,
that was the joke I was trying to find, when I was tweeting not too long ago. I said, what I'm nervous about this project is I may not be able anymore to write as badly as I used to. I do mean that as a joke because, everything has to be tweaked to fit its era.
Absolutely.
And that's why, I haven't read the Action 900.
Okay.
I don't have a problem with what they're doing. And I certainly understand why they feel the need to make that declaration. But as some of the other fans that I've been reading on the internet, have pointed out, they wouldn't have had that problem if they hadn't retconned it into the character in the first place, that he was an American citizen, because Mort Weisinger's Superman was a citizen of the world.
There you go.
And that's made that very, very clear. And even though, they had that television series going, driving the sales of the comics, Truth, Justice in the American Way, even Mort understood, not from a political perspective, but from just a logistical one, that he had to be a citizen of the world. And of course, what people who didn't read the comics of Mort Weisinger, but have only seen his stuff reprinted or, stories reproduced on the internet, what they're usually missing is the letter columns. And you have to go back and read in the original editions those letter columns to get a real sense of the machinery that was driving those books. Mort did entire stories, and I know this because he trained Nelson Bridwell, and I had my tussles with Nelson Bridwell. Mort would build entire stories to answer a question that a reader would, some logical flaw that a reader would see in a story. Mort loved what he called boo-boo hunting. If you could find a mistake in the book, and you wrote it in the letter column, he would have entire sections of his letter columns devoted to making fun of his own mistakes, usually printing errors, things miscolored and so on. And if he could get a joke out of it, he would. So there was a very, Mort was a fan of science fiction first, before he became an editor, because of course there were no comics. He was one of the people who was, you know, involved in the creation of comics.
Right.
And, but he also understood in a way that Stan Lee and all the other people of his generation did the importance of breeding a fan base, even though it wasn't quantifiable or measurable in the days of the returnable, comic book. There was no way to know, you know, who was reading the books or why. You could only, you know, make vague guesses at that. But Mort understood the value of breeding that reader who would come back month after month. And it was a hard thing to do because at that time the presumption was that because of the spotty distribution that you had to craft the book for anybody who's picking up a comic book for the first time. And so that's how you get that really awkward, clunky, expository style that we like to make fun of. You know, characters run around saying things like, as you know, I come from the fifth dimension, you know. And, you know, today a kid would look at that guy, well, if he knows it already, what the hell are you telling him for?
Understood. Well, that's the thing, and I'm glad you say that, to put these stories in their perspective, because their proper era and perspective, because I felt a lot of the Weisinger stories were also satire. And sometimes people just roll their eyes at, God, why does Superman have a bug head? Or I remember the Vaughn Meter parody of Lois and Superman as a married couple, and that, you know, there was a Vaughn Meter kind of comedian character that was imitating Superman and had a woman imitating Lois, and that it's this smash record. And it's
I believe President Kennedy was in that, and so was Marilyn Monroe, which was right ahead of the 8-year-old.
Exactly, and a great embarrassment. But again, that plays to what you're saying, too, in terms of they weren't sure who was reading. It reminds me of a comic strip, in the relationship between the audience and the property. Because, and it sounds like Weisinger treated it the same way that, you know, maybe Milton Caniff treated, you know, Terry the Pirates and Steve Canyon, and playing to this regular audience. I just think that, yeah, you're right. I think there are a lot of jokes that are missed by people who go back and look at it now, don't understand what was going on and what was contemporary in that era, and just see some of these stories as, why would Superman put a beetle wig on, or whatever kind of
right.
thing. So that's cool, and I appreciate.
Well, they were always big at on you know, cross promotions.
Sure.
At DC when they could make them happen, and that was always the hard part, because nobody went into investment spend, you know, and those things don't happen, you know, with a permission from an agent giving them carte blanche without money changing hands. And so the last time I think they did a guest shot in the Superman books that was where the person was actually meaningful to the audience was Perry Como.
In the late 40s. Oh, God, even the late
50s. Because I remember when Julie would try to do them, some of those things were really, really strange. And I remember there's a Batman issue where Batman meets William B. Williams.
Oh, my God. One of the radio giants.
Yeah, but he was local, though.
New York guy. Yeah, he was a New York guy. Absolutely.
And I grew up in the New York area, right? So I'm looking at this, and I'm a kid. And I know who William B. Williams is only because my grandfather listens to it. Right? And I'm looking at this thing, and I'm going, what the – is this?
Absolutely.
You know? Batman and William B. Williams? Right? There were a lot of other strange things like that, like Antonino Rocco in Superman, the wrestler. And there's a famous Superman cover from, like, 1962 where, you know, Rocca is throwing Superman out of the ring. And I looked at this, and, of course, it accomplished for me what its goal was, which was to make me think that Rocco was famous. It wasn't until years later that, you know, I had mentioned, you know, to my dad, well, you remember Antonino Rocca? And he's like, who? You know, no clue. So, I mean, clearly, by that point in the 60s, they had gotten to the point where they weren't paying any money for the promotions. And what they were, you know, they were dealing with people who had more to gain by being publicized by Superman than the other way around.
Well, and then I remember Alan Funt, of course, from Candid Camera being on a cover in a story.
That one, I think, was orchestrated actually by a personal relationship.
Oh, okay.
Somebody at DC was
knew Alan Funt.
Relative of or knew Alan Funt.
Interesting.
And that's the way a lot of those in the 60s, because, you know, again, particularly in the 60s, the revenue stream from the Superman series had slowed way down, or at least they thought in the early 60s that was going to be the case, because when that thing went off the air, nobody knew, you know, 50 years later, George Reeves would still be flying around on somebody's television set.
Yeah.
And they had no idea that it would become the cash cow that it is. And there's another interesting thing, too, just talking about celebrity. I won't go off into a whole diatribe about it, but I'm fascinated by how all of the, you know, and there's only two of them left anymore. I think Noel and Jack Larson are the only ones who are left from the original series. But how all of those people who you know, they're just like the Star Trek people. You know, they wanted to distance themselves from it because they thought they would have more of a career. And then it sort of was clear that that's all they were ever going to be. You know, no matter what Jack Larson did for the rest of his life, he was always going to be Jimmy Olsen to somebody. And he got into a completely new, different line of work as a librettist and poetry and oral read, you know, dramatic readings and all the rest of that, because he couldn't get work as an actor. Eventually he came to embrace it. And if you look at the last Superman movie, that's probably the most prestigious, certainly highest budgeted production that Noel Neal ever appeared in.
Understood. Absolutely. Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Well, I said, while I understand people's reaction to that film and a lot of the sense that, you know, Singer's choices were not the choices they would have made, I applaud him for doing that. And I'm just sorry that Jack's bigger part had to get cut. He was, you know, they called him Bibbo, but he bore no resemblance to the Bibbo character from the comics.
Right.
It was a slightly, I understand in the rough cut, it was a slightly larger part. So I wrote the comic book adaptation for that, and it was a bigger part in the script, and I think they actually shot it. But, you know, anyway, so yeah, it is a completely different style, and I'm not so sure that I would agree, you know, with people who are saying things on the internet now, like, well, they're nervous about Goyer, you know, right, being the writer of the next Superman movie, if Action 900 is any indication. I will tell you this just from the base, on the basis of what I know in terms of writing craft. When I found out how short that story was, I admired Goyer's guts, because that's a very ambitious theme to try to address in so few pages.
You bet.
And that may be the problem that some people are having with it. I don't know, but I'm eager to read it as soon as I get this project done, and I don't have to worry about, you know, getting inadvertently confused.
I can appreciate that. Before we forget about Jack Larson, I want to let people know that another great performance as Jimmy Olsen that he had was in the Lois and Clark TV show, if they never saw it.
Oh, that's right, right,
and,
right.
And that was a great moment for him to revisit the character and really speak from the heart in terms of suddenly Jimmy finds himself aged to be an old man. And,
right.
And they let Jack Larson play the elder Jimmy Olsen. And it was just magic seeing him be Jimmy Olsen again. And
at that time. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it was just fun, and it was this, you know, great little added, you know, bonus of having the real Jimmy Olsen get to be Jimmy again and finding a way of making it work at that age.
Well, Warner Brothers Television was very, very big on stunt casting at that time. You'll recall one of the last things Bob Shane did before he died was play the recurring blind newsboy in – not newsman, rather. I'm sorry. And I think it was Flash, was it?
Bob Shane. I'm
Robert Shane. Inspector Henderson from the...
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, no, I had no idea that Henderson made it in The Flash. That's fantastic.
Yes, Shane was blind in real life at that point.
Wow.
He was in his early 90s.
Unbelievable.
But they put him in that – I believe it was Flash. And, of course, there was other stunt casting in Lois and Clark as well. Didn't Phyllis Coates play Lois's mother in the wedding?
Yes, that's right. I forgot about that too. Holy cow.
I have a suspicion that a lot of that was instigated by Mike Carlin, who was at that time the liaison between Warner Brothers Television and DC, at least on the Superman stuff.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I took over some of that from him. Well, in fact, actually all of that stuff, because they put it in the Department of Special Projects.
Department of Special Projects?
Yeah. So I was the guy there, you know, for about 5 years, vetting the scripts, reading all of the scripts from the animated stuff, just the TV, not the features. As I understood it, because of Mike's background, his long association with the character, but also, you know, he and, Carrie Bates and, Mark Jones wasn't Mark Jones is the guy I know from animation. He was the story editor on Superboy, but he didn't have anything to do with comics, so I'm getting a little confused here. But
okay.
Carlin and Bates wrote episodes of Superboy.
Yes.
The syndicated series. And the degree to which that show tried to be faithful to the mythology, Carlin was driving a lot of that. Cary Bates was one of the story editors, and Carlin wrote, and Andy Helfer, as a team, wrote a lot of scripts for them. And this is why you had people like Michael... Oh, but I'm blanking on his name now. The fellow who played Mr. McCess, but like Michael Pollard, Michael J. Pollard.
Oh, sure, okay.
Showing up in these rather awkwardly stitched together costumes, but they looked right. And of course, that show is a perfect example of why people redesign things for the films. Because what you learn from looking at Superboy is just because it looks good on the comic book page doesn't necessarily mean it's going to look good in three dimensions. And this is one of the frustrations I have when people, I used to have that rather, when fans would look at, things like the X-Men movie and go, well, why aren't they wearing their yellow and blue costumes? Because they won't look good.
I just spoke to Joe Quesada last week, and we had the same conversation. And not only
I haven't caught up with that podcast yet, John. I'm sorry.
That's all right, man. No, I got a name drop, obviously, because it's interesting, and I want you to speak to this as well. He thinks beyond the limitations of film in general, he even thinks that you can get away with more on film with spandex or variations of spandex than you can on television. And as someone who's worked so much in television, I want your opinion on that, because he just says it's even more realistic and it just feels more real and more grounded, for lack of a better word, to get away with putting. I mean, I remember, was it Nightman, the Steve Englehart idea that was in syndication,
right? Mm-hmm.
20 years ago. And that's the thing, the times that they really do try to be faithful and give you a real superhero feel, it comes off goofy. God, even on Smallville, I loved the casting of the Justice Society on Jeff Johns's 2-hour movie last year, and Michael Shanks was an excellent Hawkman until he put the feathered helmet on, and then he looked kind of goofy. I mean, he looked great with the wings, but I just felt that you put the helmet on, and it's like, yeah, I don't know, man.
But I don't know that. I guess what I'm trying to figure out in listening to you is, what would this distinction be between television and film? It's not really budgetary so much anymore. I mean, because people don't commit to the kinds of visuals that you have to create when doing science fiction or fantasy anymore, unless they know that they've got a back end market, either in, the DVD or whatever. Major suppliers can deficit finance. So what I'm saying is that from the perspective of a Disney or a Warner Brothers, the budgetary restrictions from, of television over features, I don't think are that dramatic. What may be at work is timing. You do have the limitation of there's only so much you can build.
Right.
In terms of a costume.
Even CGI, let's even say, because, I mean, I know right. that there are a lot of just special effects where you'll see a character in costume and it looks sure. very real, but obviously it was totally CGI'd. I mean, Spider-Man, half the scenes of him, swinging through New York and stuff, really, those are all computer generated. It's not an actor in a blue screen like the Reeves days,
And the more extreme use of the CGI is to create the form-fitting look and all the kinds of things that are apparently the new approaches that they're taking to Green Lantern.
Yes.
Where, it's all motion capture, and the costume, as I understand it, is essentially CGI'd onto Ryan Reynolds. I'm not – from a budgetary standpoint, it's one thing. If we're going to talk aesthetics, of course, this is all completely subjective, but I'm even more of a purist. I have the fundamental problem I have with superhero movies is that level, even with the CGI, that level of unreality always looks hokey to me, no matter how much money they throw at it. So to me, aesthetically, the difference that you're describing between television and feature films doesn't really, I don't really see that. I would go so far as to say this kind of stuff works better in animation, because the suspension of disbelief necessary, I just can't make it. I can't make the leap. Now, maybe that's a generational thing. I don't know. But no matter how well designed the costume, no matter how good the actor, I still think of Ben Affleck. I mean, I'll back up and say my personal favorite movie in which somebody wore a Superman costume in a feature film is still Hollywoodland. And I remember that moment when, as Reeves, Ben Affleck looks in the mirror and says, I look like a damn fool. And I remember sitting with audiences that I could always tell how many comic book fans there were in the audience by how loud the groan of disapproval to that line was. And a lot of very hardcore Superman fans completely drop out of the picture, if you know what I mean by that.
Interesting.
They stop being engaged by the film at that point.
I hear you. Absolutely. Funny.
And it had to be there because it's integral to the story. The man burned the costume after every season.
Did he? Always,
yes.
That's true. George Reeves did that.
It was a little ritual for him because his hope was that he would escape it. And it was just like this. And I have to assume that, you know, when they were wrapped for the season, he was drinking pretty heavily. But that was no, I've heard that from a number of sources of people.
Wow.
Who were on the show, that it was and it was written into his contract that that's what he could do. They gave him the costume at the end of the season, and he'd go over to the barbecue grill and set it on fire.
Wow. God, he was such a perfect Superman. He was such, I mean, and obviously maybe because I started watching it at 4 years old and never stopped. And
well,
just,
no, because,
you know,
I don't think that's just it. If you look back at a lot of that stuff, it really holds up. The fact
it absolutely does.
That the tragedy of George Reeves is that he was 10 times better an actor than he was ever given the opportunity to demonstrate.
Understood.
And Jack Larson, we're talking about somebody who was trained in New York, trained in the method, a contemporary of Montgomery Clift's, surrounded by all of these people in Hollywood saying, Jack, you're so good. Why are you doing this? Well, because he was stuck. He was trapped. The famous story is the agents told all of these people, don't worry about it. It's this television thing. Nobody's going to see it. Don't worry about it. And they signed these contracts that gave them they gave away their availability so that on a moment's notice, they had to go back and do the TV show. So they couldn't do a Broadway show. They couldn't do features. They couldn't do anything. They were trapped by Superman. And if you look at it from the actor's perspective, it's a heartbreaking story. And the movie captures that so beautifully. By doing that thing of, again, this is a use of CGI for you. They put Affleck optically into the one scene, one sizable scene that they left in the picture, From Here to Eternity, where Malon Stark, the character that George Reeves is playing, and Burt Lancaster is, I believe, Pruitt,
mm-hmm.
are walking along. And it's the scene where Burt Lancaster finds out that his officer's wife, with whom he's having an affair, is, shall we say, very popular with the troops. And because Lancaster's character asks Reeves, how do you know this? And he looks at him and says, because I was one of them myself. And it's a beautifully played moment. And it's the only – and he had out of many similarly substantial scenes, because Malin Stark is a major supporting character in the novel, that Reeves had in the film. They were all cut. That was the only one that was left. So what they did is they go back and they recreate the moment in the theater in a sneak preview where the minute Reeves comes on screen, everybody in the theater goes, oh, look, it's Superman, and they're laughing. Oh, Superman, are you going to fly now, Superman? And they cut to Reeves slinking down in his chair.
Wow.
And the actor playing Jack Larson, they do a cutaway of him, as I recall, or either he's in the master. I don't know, master shot. Because that's also one of the most heartbreaking stories I've ever heard, is listening to Jack talk about that moment. He said, I looked over into the eyes of a man whose career was over. And that's really the way it played out.
Yeah.
And I see, my problem is, as much as I love escapism and fantasy, I'm at a point in life, I guess, where the real world is a lot more interesting, I think, than you know, some of the flights of fantasy that are, you know, bringing kids out and their families out to the movie theater. I'll tell you though, the way I think the perfect way to do a superhero film would be Pixar.
Sure.
I'm wondering if Disney will go in that direction with Marvel.
Yeah, you know, well, and I have to say, on both sides of the street, including Warner Brothers and DC, I think the animated films that have been going direct to video have been getting better and better. The characterization is better. It's much more sophisticated storytelling than it was in the Saturday morning era. and really even, you know, as recently as I'd say 20 years ago. It started with, you know, as you know, being part of the Mask of the Phantasm, one of the writers on that. I think it started with the Bruce Timm and Alan Burnett and company, doing the Batman, TV show. But I really think that sensibility has now progressed to the direct to videos. All-Star Superman is a very complex story. And I think they captured, the late Dwayne McDuffie did a great job in capturing the essence of that in his script. And Andrew Romano, as you know, is a wonderful voice director and is able to cast actors that can really make this stuff pay off. So it doesn't surprise me that you would say that Pixar, and of course The Incredibles was such a great movie,
That was the great change in animation that was so much fun to be a part of. When I started in animation, the voices weren't even thought of as acting. They were thought of as voiceovers. And in point of fact, the people doing the voices were tended to be called from the ranks of DJs.
Sure.
Top 40 radio.
Stereo, absolutely.
And there was a reason for that. Casey Kasem doing all those voices.
Yeah.
And there was a reason for that. That was just a long-standing tradition. People who knew how to act with their voices, knew how to keep the mouth on mic, but do the whole range of things and stunt voices and all the rest of that. Those people came from radio. So you will see in cartoons of the 40s and 50s, a lot of the people doing them were also on the radio. I mean, if you look at, Columbia Workshop, which was one of the last, sustained programs in radio in the late 50s, Dawes Butler, June Foray, Arthur Q. Bryan, who was the only voice at Warner Brothers that, that Mel Blanc didn't do, supposedly.
Elmer Fudd, yeah.
Exactly. So what you see are people moving back and forth between animation and radio. Well, then what happened? Hans Conried is a perfect example, too.
Yeah.
But then what happened? Well, radio was killed. Theatrical radio was killed.
Right, right.
So this whole talent pool of people who knew how to act with their voices shrunk, and all you had left were, you know, essentially pitchmen. So this is why, and it worked in the other way too, which is that, you know, with the exception of his brief stint, as Lou Grant's boss on television, Mason Adams, who was known primarily, was known, just died not too long ago, but I think maybe about, 7 or 8 years ago, and he was well into his 90s, the Smuckers voice.
Yes, it did.
With a name like Smuckers, it has to be good. He did that gig for close to 30 years. Because he was, one of the last serials. I think One in His Family, Pepper Young Family, one of those things. I don't know.
Gotcha.
And then when that went away, he moved into doing commercials. So somewhere along the line, people got it conflated in their minds that that's where you got the voices from. And then the pay structure and after and all the rest of those factors. Made it not a particularly lucrative place for actors to go. But once you had big studios like Warner Brothers and Disney deficit financing, throwing money at these things, that they could do buyouts, it was a great, great way to work. You know, nobody had to get dressed up.
Oh, absolutely.
I've seen more celebrities in shorts and t-shirts than and wearing headsets. And and that was what was so fascinating, was having a chance during the breaks to talk to them a little bit. The read-throughs, the story editors for a time on Batman would sit in because not everybody could be assembled. You know, a lot of stuff was done with phone patches, people in London.
Yeah, remote studios, absolutely. Yeah, ISDN right. Lines and stuff and phone lines. Now I know what you mean.
Right. So what we would do, obviously, is they'd have somebody record a scratch track so that the actors could have something to respond to, throw lines back and forth. So, hey, I can say, although nobody will ever see it or hear it, I've acted with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., Ed Asner, I mean, a whole list of people. And boy, was that exciting. Because
I bet.
Because you nailed it. That was acting. And so that they've now had close to 2 decades to perfect that. So I think that's what you're hearing in things like All-Star Superman. And, of course, you know, it's sad to have to speak of him in the past tense, but, you know, Dwayne was a magnificent writer. And that's a real blow.
Yeah,
that's a real loss to the industry.
Did you work closely with Dwayne during the animation years?
No. Dwayne Dwayne came to Warner Animation after I left.
Okay.
My interaction with Dwayne was one of those unfortunate ones where, you know, having been on both sides of the fence, I understood that he was not happy about having to hear what he had to hear from me. I used to say that I was the,
you're the messenger.
I was the director in charge of no, you can't do that.
Understood.
Was what my job was. All of the Warner Brothers divisions had access to the DC characters, but there was nobody like there is now. And it's essentially a big part of Geoff Johns' job now, from what I understand. There was nobody coordinating the use of the characters. And the studio at that time had the mistaken impression that it owned everything. But there were things like rights participation deals, bonuses that had to be paid to the talent who had created these characters. And it was all well and good to simply open up the door and say, here, you know, play with our toy box, as Paul Levitz would have put it. But the studio had to know, DC had to know what was going on to make sure that the talent would get paid. He didn't want to be in a position of getting a phone call from someone who was disgruntled that they'd seen their character on television and DC didn't know about it. It was at one time very, very easy to keep track of because there wasn't that much stuff. But once the Batman movies of the 90s made it clear, and the TV activity, the Flash on television, and this is a good many years before Smallville. Once it became clear that the superhero was not a passing fancy, it was not a genre that was going to go away like the swashbuckler, but that superheroes were here to stay, it opened the floodgates. More and more divisions of the studio, such as independent producers with an exclusive, you know, a first look deal with the studio and so on, more and more entities wanted to do things with DC's characters. And so it became necessary to create a specialized department. And I was the first guy in that seat. Paul created it out of creative services, and it's since grown. And I think Mike is doing a lot of that now. Mike Carlin is doing that now on the coast, I understand, working with Jeff and specifically in the animation area. So, and he's eminently qualified. So, you know, he's sort of come
Certainly.
Full circle, and he's come full circle in that respect. But I was always the guy. I was always the guy who had to call up, you know, Dwayne or Alan Burnett or Stan Berkowitz or any of those guys and say, sorry, you really can't use Green Arrow yet. There's a development deal over here and they have an exclusive and that about it. And so what happened was they had to deal with me. And I understood that. There was no bad blood at all. But the conversations could be a little stressful.
Sure.
Because, you know, just a bunch of people doing their job. And, of course, with the 3,000-mile difference, it was not easy to say, listen, you know, let's go out and have a drink after all of this, you know.
Absolutely.
And we'll end, you know, we'll end shaking each other's hand. You just couldn't do that. So I would go out once a year to the Christmas party that Warner Animation had and walk around the room and press the flesh and, you know, let bygones be bygones, no hard feelings. But it's really tough after you've been pouring your heart and soul into something. You've been developing it according, you know, to the And it wasn't network knowledge. See, that's the other thing. When the supplier and the buyer are on the same side of the fence, you don't have that blame the network out that people used to use in television. You know, it was DC Comics making us do this, or it's Warner Animations insisting that we do that, but it's all in the family. And the higher up the food chain you went in terms of the appealing to the executives, the more often you would hear, we're all one company, we're all one company. But, you know, it's just the nature of the beast. So, I mean, that was my interaction, you know, with Dwayne. And it was often necessary for me to say, you know, how much we loved the script and how sad we were to have to put a spike in it. But it was due to circumstances beyond our control. But that doesn't play too well in Hollywood because there's an old story that's what you do in every meeting. Oh, we loved your script. It's just
sure.
Oh, it's magnificent. We just have a couple of notes, and then they pull out the script, and you see every single page is dog-eared. And it starts out, it's the equivalent of, oh, you know, say it's a Superman script. Do we really have to have this guy in the cape?
Brian Bettis told me, you know, he was in a meeting where they said, does it really have to be a spider when talking about Spider-Man? And then an executive actually said that. And, you know, it's, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I understand. No, I totally understand. And I'm glad you're saying this, too, because I think so many Monday Morning Quarterback fans will be the first to say, well, why isn't Green Arrow in this story? Or why couldn't
right. –
it's the same company. Why can't they use these characters? And,
well, and of course, the Smallville, the Smallville situation has made it even more ambiguous. Part of the issue with Smallville in the beginning was the fear of there being multiple iterations of a character on view at all times. They've since moved away. They've changed position on that, obviously. But part of the problem was that Alan Miles' original conceit, Al Goff and Miles Miller, mm-hmm. the original executive producers, their original conceit, of course, was that there would, you know, no tights, no flights, was their saying.
Right.
And, of course, they've gone on to bigger and better things. And Brian Peterson, I believe, was one of the writers, staff writers in the first season.
Yes.
When I was vetting the scripts, is now the showrunner. So they've moved away from that. I mean, I stopped watching Smallville a long time ago, because what was exciting for me, the show went in a different direction, let us say, you know, but I thought a lot of the stuff that was done with the Kents and on the farm, you know, a lot of that stuff in the early episodes was really sensitively, beautifully written.
I agree.
And marvelously played.
First three seasons were incredible. Incredible.
Yeah.
Kind of lost, I'll say this just as a fan, kind of lost its way in the middle. I have to say, since Goff and Miller left, they've kind of found their, the show has kind of found a new, like you said, a new philosophy, and I think it's worked on a lot of occasions. And I do think that the, you know, really, I'd say six or seven season moving on to the end, there have been a lot of strong episodes, and they've embraced the idea of tights on others.
I want to be quick to make something clear here. I don't want to leave any of your listeners, John, with the impression that I'm dissing Smallville. I just haven't watched it. The things that were, there was a belief, and it turned out to have been false, that the show was winding down several seasons ago.
Right.
When you had, you know, and when Kristen Kreuk left and all those other people.
Absolutely. Michael Rosenblum as Luther. I mean, that's the thing. The original dynamic of Clark versus Lex that it was building to has been gone for four seasons now.
Yeah.
And obviously they're coming back to it.
Since it was no longer part of my job to keep tabs on the show, it was just sort of something that, you know, that fell away. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was a very, very enjoyable part of my job. And the things that I learned from, you know, because you never stop learning. The things I learned about changes in television production, what was possible, how those scripts evolved through draft after draft, it was a great deal of fun, but, you know, it still was a job. Now, of course, they've gone, as we've been saying, in a completely different direction, which is almost as far as the early show was backing away from the conventions of superheroes. The current show moves in that direction.
Absolutely.
And the mystification that I always had in the early days when the television department was allowing Smallville and DC Comics to the extent that they were able, you know, to the extent that they had anything to say about it. Now, mind you, I'm just talking about conversations that went on above my head and I'm not privy to any of them. But I would just scratch my head as to why all of those characters were allowed or were open to Smallville, because there's still such things as transfer costs. Money changes hands between divisions for the rights and the use of the characters. Now, of course, all of that is now ancient history because of the creation of DC Entertainment. But I kept wondering, why do they want to give away the store? Why do you want to let Smallville have all of these characters when they are exploitable individually?
Certainly.
And as it turned out, I mean, it wouldn't have been any of my business to articulate that thought, and I never did. It was sort of made moot by the fact that there were all of these multiple deals, and to keep peace among, so to speak, among the divisions, DC had to try to, you know, massage and move, you know, adroitly between people. And we would try wherever possible to help them out. If we had to say no to something, we would try to come armed with an alternative suggestion. But this is history repeating itself. When I was originally on Batman, Warner Animation was being told that the costume had to be black because he was black in the movies. And he couldn't be gray and blue as in the comics.
Okay.
And then there was a fear that they were going to tell DC that Batman had to be changed in the comics. And Paul explained why that couldn't be done, or Jeanette. So they begrudgingly accepted that because, you know, everybody wants to be Disney, and Disney's idea was the model is the model. The mouse only looks one way. And people at from DC had to explain, well, it's a different style. And they would show them how Batman had been interpreted by many different artists over the years. And there was a fear that that was going to backfire on them because, you know, the bosses would say, well, then change it. But somewhere along the line, and I was not privy to any of this. I was just working on the show. But somewhere along the line, not only, and I think it was the toy people that made this point, they decided, well, no, it doesn't all have to be the same. Because you could brand the different iterations of Batman in different ways. And then that's how the whole thing with DC's licensing department and Cheryl Boobin started with, you know, the style guides for animation look, film look, comic book look. And then later that got broken down into Golden Age, Contemporary. Every time there would be some change, some major event, a new style guide would be issued. But they went click buzz. If he all looks the same, then you only have one toy line. But
right.
If the public will accept three or four different iterations of Batman simultaneously, you can have four toy lines.
Absolutely.
Ka-ching, ka-ching. And so that's where we are now.
Yes,
in the sense that there is no concern that the Oliver Queen on Smallville won't necessarily have anything to do with the Oliver Queen in a Green Arrow property, you know, film or television property, if they decide to do one.
Sure.
I think, of course, again, I'm not privy to what Geoff Johns is thinking, so maybe there is more of a sense of unification there. But I'm hearing from Charles, not hearing from him I'm reading comments from Charles Robin, who's recently been asked to address the idea of whether Batman and Superman will meet, because that was an idea about 10 years ago.
Yes, Wolfgang Peterson, I remember, was talked about as a possible director for a Batman-Superman movie.
Yes, with Lorenzo Di Bonaventura as the executive producer on that. And that didn't happen for a variety of reasons, which, you know, are no one's business but Mr. Di Bonaventura's. But Rovin has been quoted as saying that's not in the cards.
Interesting.
Sure. Well, actually, when you think about it, since both the Superman and Batman film franchises are growing organically out of the source material, the movies would then have exactly the same problem that DC itself has been wrestling with for the last 20 years. Batman, a creature of darkness. Superman, a creature of the daytime. How do you get them together? And you have seen in the DC comics since World's Finest, which was always on its own planet, even when it was...
I know what you mean.
Even in the Silver Age.
Yeah.
You have seen a succession of creatives trying to wrestle with how do you put the two of them together. Because the more of their own identity and the more of their own character that they evolved in their individual strips, with Denny taking Batman into the very, very dark place, and then Byrne being brought in to retcon Superman, he had no choice but to make them antagonists, and that's the way they were played. People wary of each other. And Denny wasn't even entirely happy with that. I mean, Denny's philosophy was always Batman. Denny had some problems with Batman. Denny O'Neill, the editor. Denny O'Neill, the Batman group editor for many years.
Yes.
Just for your younger listeners.
Oh, absolutely. No. This is good.
Denny, I understand, had some reservations, actually, about Batman appearing with anybody.
I've heard that.
Yeah. And it makes sense. And it makes sense, because you can't, in a universe in which sales are dependent upon an industry-wide continuity, as opposed to what you had in the Silver Age and before it, which is that all the DC books sort of existed in their own little world. And the only time they ever came together was in Justice League, but there was very, very little reference to their individual lives in Justice League. More so with the characters that Julie controlled. But if you look at Justice League, Batman and Superman didn't really have that active a role in Justice League until the Batman television series. in 66, and then Batman was on the cover of everything. Batman was meeting Jerry Lewis.
That's right.
But
true.
It's yeah. But in today's world, where everything crosses over and there's that kind of interconnectedness, it's the Marvel approach. It's the combined world. You have to. You can't drop aspects of characterization as if we're just going to take all of what we know about this character and just put it over here so that he can go and play in the sand with Batman or Superman. That's not going to happen. So it's very, very interesting to see that everything that the comics have known about how to treat their characters in comics is being played out on a much larger canvas of the motion picture, you know? And so the thought occurred to me when I was reading the quotes from Robin is that he might as well be Denny O'Neill talking about the characters. You know, Superman occupies his world and Batman occupies his, and that's all the further we're thinking at this point.
That's fine.
It'll certainly be interesting to see what they do with Superman.
Indeed. And it seems like a lot of good people are behind it, but I'm curious about the film too. Now, what you say though about Superman and Batman in the Justice League makes me want to ask you this question. With the current environment of event books and publisher-wide event books, were you still writing comics in the time of Crisis on Infinite Earths? That seems to be around the time that I can't remember if you stopped writing monthly comics or not. The first Crisis, because I wonder how you would react to now. Every year there's an obligatory event that everybody's book has to kind of point in that same direction, and I think whatever individual storylines might have to be set aside to tie into whatever the current status quo of the universe is.
No, the original Crisis was done, interestingly, you asked this question, it was done the very first year of my career in which I didn't do any comic book work at all because the TV stuff had taken up so much of my time. That was the year I had to leave Swamp Thing. Boy, was that an interesting thing. And it's taken me 20 years to get to the point where I'm starting to read people saying, his version of Swamp Thing wasn't all that bad.
That's good.
So, and the joke I make is, you remember me, I'm the Swamp Thing writer whose stuff apparently didn't totally suck after all. sometimes it's not only difficult to follow an act, sometimes it's difficult to proceed a one.
Understood.
A good one like
yeah, that's right. Somebody, some British guy, I guess.
Looks a little bit like Rasputin. I don't know.
A little bit.
Anyway, so I had to leave Swamp Thing, and all of that stuff with Bob Greenberger and Len Wein and Marv Wolfman and Dick Giordano, all of whom were good friends of mine. And Mike Gold wasn't really directly, I don't think he was with the company at this point. I'm not really sure. Cause maybe it was a couple of years later that he became part of the development group, and he was the guy who got me back into comics. But I had already by that point started to move away from superheroes, because it was becoming more continuity intensive. And in those days, I hate that expression. At that time, always a much better phrase. At that time. We're talking about an era where there's no such thing as email, no such thing as PDFs.
Sure.
Federal Express was a novelty. So it was still difficult to have an active dance card in comics from being 3,000 miles away. Some people, when it wasn't a full-time gig, the guys I knew in LA at that time who were full-time comics guys, were very few, and they were the only ones who were able to make being 3,000 miles away work. And they were also heavy hitters. But a lot of those guys were out there in the first place to get into television, specifically animation. It was only until the technologies made it feasible that it was possible to be anywhere in the world and actively keep up a full work in comics. And then when I came back in, it was after the Crisis. And I was happy to do things that the continuity didn't affect. And in fact, all of the changes were being played out when I was writing for Action Comics Weekly. I was doing Blackhawk.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's right. And later Secret Six.
Before.
Oh.
Before. What happened was I had pitched the Secret Six reboot. Dick Giordano bought it. And it turned out that because of all the stuff I was doing in television, I had become much faster and much more disciplined, and I understood structure. And I was also old enough to have written a lot of comics that were 8 and 9, 11 pages long, which, we were discovering those kinds of writers were in very short supply. So what happened was I was getting, especially when the Writers Guild strike came along, I was getting way ahead on the Secret Six, and we'd finished those two cycles. And Mike Gold called me up and said, I have the perfect assignment for you. And you're talking to a guy who's never read a war comic, had never read a war comic in his life, had never read a single issue of Blackhawk. He said, I have the perfect assignment for you, Blackhawk. And since we were on strike and I needed the money, my reaction was sort of like, oh, okay, sure, yeah, it's the perfect thing for me. And I hung up the phone. And I'm like, what? Blackhawk? Where did you know? And I had to do it. I had to do it for the money. And I thought, I'm totally incapable of doing that. And it turned out to be the work I think I'm proudest of in comics.
I was going to say, Marty, it's one of my favorite things that you wrote, and what a great era to set Blackhawk in. It's that post-war era and that Cold War era, if you will, of Blackhawk, I thought was really interesting.
Well, what sold me on it was apparently what had happened was Mike Grell had started the weekly feature in Action, and Mike wanted more of the Chaykin feel.
Yes.
And less of the Milton Caniff, Perry and the Pirates
sure.
kind of thing that Mike wanted to do. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that approach. You know, they're equally valid. They're just different approaches. And so he said, this is where we want to bring it back to. And he sent me the miniseries.
Chaykin's miniseries, sure.
Yeah. And I was astonished at how cinematic it was because I had not read American Flag by that point. I did go back and read it later. And I was not aware that Howard was doing work in film or television. But I just, wow. And you could even see it. He was so in control of his style in that thing that you could even see where the editor's hand was. There's one, I think only one panel in the entire three issues of that miniseries where, Janosz Proszka has a thought balloon because Howard didn't write thought balloons. It's all a storyboard. It's all cinematic, the scene structure. When he cuts to a new location, somewhere within the first three panels, if not the first, there's an establishing shot. And he – no captions. And I looked at this. I said, whoa, this is wonderful. It was challenging. You had to read it a couple of times. You couldn't just skim read it the way you could the comics back in the day. But it made a demand on the reader. That's what I really loved. And putting that together with what I learned about screenwriting, that was a whole new style. And I've evolved that over the years so that coming back to this retroactive thing, oh, my God. You know, comics in general reflect the more cinematic approach all across the board. What was done in the Silver Age or the Bronze Age or whatever the hell age I'm supposed to be part of, those comics saw the comic book medium is more of a print medium to be read. More, what am I trying to say? More prosy than cinematic. Now all comics are storyboards with dialogue balloons added. For the most part.
Understood.
Unless they are deliberately prosy and literary like the Vertigo stuff. And the Vertigo stuff is another animal unto itself.
Sure.
Am I going on too long for you?
Not at all. No, I'm enjoying it. And now that you're back
don't get into this, John.
No.
You're like, don't get me started.
No, no, but that's good. And no, honestly, Marty, you know, people appreciate learning this perspective of not only the past eras, but also what you're doing now and what you will be doing. And that's why, as you say, with the retroactive book, working with Eduardo Barreto,
interesting. I'm dying to see what Eduardo does. This is the other thing that I didn't understand. It's not necessarily an attempt to recreate the look of the books.
That's what I was wondering. Although because some of the other pairs that they've put together, will evoke a specific art style as well as story style. And I was wondering if Eduardo was chosen to mimic a Jose Luis Garcia or perhaps Kurt Swan style? I wasn't really sure.
I have to tell you, it happened very, very quickly. When it was offered to me, I jumped at it. I said, oh, this will be great fun, and it would be great to reestablish, my byline in comics. But had I known, there used to be a saying in this business, you're not fully committed until the solicitation goes out. And I thought, well, I know when they say they want it, but you know, until I know when the book ships, you know, I didn't feel committed. And when I completely committed when I got off the phone, and within 2 days of them approaching me, they made the announcement at WonderCon. And then the solicitation went right out. So I was like, oh my God. And then my life, you know, sort of, you know, fell completely apart thereafter. So it's been a little bit, it's been a little bit rougher going than I would have liked, but, I don't really know, as far as the '70s goes. Yeah. They're the three groupings are different kettles of fish. The ones from the '90s, it's a lot easier to recreate that look.
Because, sure.
To be honest. Most of the people aren't dead. That was the other thing I really enjoyed. You know, why do you think the Superman to Martin Pasta? Well, he's still alive.
But Carrie and Elliot are still alive, for example. That's not nice.
Well, that's why it's a joke. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's like.
I don't mean you. I've seen other people maybe saying that.
This is why I'm really, really interested to see what Len Wein and Marv Wolfman and Denny O'Neill come up with.
Absolutely.
Their styles have evolved too. They've kept current. And I haven't had a chance, you know, I've been so busy, I haven't had a chance to touch base with any of those guys. But, I would love to know if they are having, that was the other thing too. I didn't know I was first up. I didn't realize that the books were coming out in July. So, I mean, obviously Louise Simonson and, John Bogdanov will just do what they do.
Sure.
No sweat. The '80s, I forget who.
Yeah, I'm blanking too now, and I can look it up, I suppose. But I'm curious about that. I have to say, as an aside, Kerry Bates did a great Elseworlds Superman story last year.
Yes,
that really flew under the radar, and I think if people didn't pick it up, go back and find it. I don't know if it's going to be traded or not. I hope it is, because it's a wonderful story, and the idea of that. Jor-El was not only to be able to send Kal-El to Earth, but also his whole family, and that they continue to, you know, live among us as a family unit. And it was
I'm really happy for Kerry, because in all the time that he was writing Superman, not the Flash, but Superman, he was heavily rewritten first by Mort and then by Julie.
Interesting.
And he had never seen Kerry left to his own devices writing Superman. Even in what used to have been called, what was once called an imaginary story. So I was really happy for him to show what he could do, because, you know, I assisted Julie at various times. I winced and felt pain for how heavily Kerry was rewritten. I don't know why. It was just one of those things that Julie just got it into his head that Kerry wasn't good with dialogue. What Kerry was understated. And it was the sort of thing where Kerry understood. He was a very, very visual writer. I hate to speak about him in the past tense. He's still with us, of course. But sure. I'm talking about when he was doing this stuff. He was very visually oriented. Remember, this was a guy like Jim Shooter who started out submitting cover ideas to Mort Weisinger, and he drew them himself. So he was always telling the story in visuals and did not write copy to get in its way. Julie wanted more bombast. Unfortunately, Julie, as I said before, by his own admission, was not much of a writer. And I would wince at some of the stuff that I would see. And apparently Mort did the same thing. We saw a little bit of what Kerry would do. We saw Kerry's writing when he was the writer-editor of The Flash.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I don't recall there being much response to it. What I mean by response, I don't recall hearing a lot of people saying, wow, he's like a completely different writer. It's night and day. But then again, I wasn't in New York at that point, and I wasn't hanging around those kinds of circles. And of course, this is before the internet, so I wasn't hanging around the kind of people that I would hear that, you know, from. So I was very, very happy to see him do that.
Was that midway through the Flash run or near the end when he was both writer editor?
As I recall, it was briefly. It was at a point at which Carmine was drawing it.
Okay. Well, then, that's why I'm thinking too that it was maybe during that trial of Barry Allen period when, frankly, I mean, that is when I know sales were kind of ebbing away.
I don't have any windows, you know, and Google open in front of me.
Sure.
Here, so more the fool I, if I am completely imagining.
Well, and shame on me if I'm getting it wrong as well. I've now found Marv is going to be with Sergio Cariello. or doing the lost story from the 80s.
Right.
So that's the artist for the month.
Right. So obviously the further back you reach, the harder it is to find people. With the writers, it's a little bit easier because so many of us started very, very young. I mean, I started in this business when I was 17. Carrie was about the same age. Of course, we all know the legend of Jim Shooter. He started when he was 14.
Yeah. Crazy.
And that's the only reason why Joe Kubert, for example, has had as long a career as he has had.
Yeah, another guy who started at 13, I guess, in Eisner Studio.
Yep.
So yeah,
and he's in his 80s now. So this is how you have a 50-year body of work from that guy. 60 years.
70 years.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, Kurt Swan is gone, and I don't think they feel that there is anything to be gained by being deliberately as, and again, I'm not dissing Kurt Swan, God knows, but for lack of a better word, undynamic, if you will.
Yeah, I understand. You know, though, it was, I don't know if it was comfort food. I don't know how to explain it because you're right, but there had to be something there in, and this is mixing metaphors, the subtext of Kurt's art, because I know what you mean. And I know a lot of artists that sit there and say, yeah, it's just there. But I even heard Dan Close at a con speaking to like how great Kurt Swan's deceptively dull style actually was.
I think putting your finger on it, Kurt was a brilliant draftsman. And you're talking to somebody who did dozens of pages with him. He actually, when he was called upon to do the wilder things, particularly some of Julie's very science fiction-oriented kinds of things, he could slip into the silly zone very, very easily.
Sure.
Because he was just never comfortable with that. It always amazed me that here is this guy who all he really wanted out of life was to be a realistic painter like Norman Rockwell or an advertising guy. But he found a steady paycheck early in his career in comics. And it was hard for him to let go, and he raised a family, and before he knew it, there's my career. You know, he always reminded me of that old line that William Shatner uses now, which is, this isn't the career I had in mind, but it is the career. This isn't the career that I had envisioned, but it is the career I seem to have. Now, this is similar to what we were talking about before. Everybody eventually, they make their peace with it, just as Jack Larson
right.
and Noel Neal made their peace with the fame that the television series brought them. And so it always struck me as rather odd that somebody like Kurt would be known for the fantastic material that was Superman. But I think in his time, he served the material extremely well because something more stylized, something more like the stuff that Julie was doing in the science fiction books at the time. And people forget this too. Kurt Swan drew the first issue, the lead story in the first issue of Strange Adventures because he could do likenesses very, very well. And the very first issue of Strange Adventures was an adaptation of the movie Destination Moon, which Kurt drew.
Wow.
And he did everything that they threw at him. He was also a stylistic mimic. People don't remember this. Are you aware that his very first gig for DC was mimicking Jack Kirby?
No, I wasn't. That's interesting. Challenges?
Yes.
Challenges and owner?
No.
Even
earlier than that, late 1946.
Wow.
Boy Commandos.
Oh, sure.
And Newsboy Legion.
Holy cow. I didn't know Kurt Swan did those.
Yeah. When Jack and Joe Simon left DC to go to Price Crestwood and create the Romance comics.
Yes.
They scrambled to find, you know, and it was like, Kurt himself used to say, you know, I just happened to walk in the door that day. I think anybody who had walked in that day would have been given this assignment because they were not given much advance notice. And what they did was they retained the services of the inker, I forget his name, who was inking Jack on both features. And Kurt drew it and tried to mimic Jack's style to the best of his ability, and then the rest of it was filled in by the inker. But I remember when I was doing a lot of the preliminary research, making suggestions to Bennett Toshin's company.
Yes.
Paul Evitz's 75 years of DC.
Yes, the gigantic book that mm-hmm. cannot support any lamp whatsoever.
Right. Yes, it's a It's the only book I've ever seen that should have wheels on it.
You know? Absolutely, man. It cuts off your circulation if you decide to curl up with it, literally.
Everybody's done those jokes, I'm sure. You know, remember the old joke from Seinfeld, you know,
the coffee Michael table book.
Yes, the coffee table book. Yes, it actually is a coffee table.
I do know that other Tasham volumes used to come with display tables because they were so big.
I look at the size of these things, and then I look at the retail price point, and I say, you know, God love you for the work you do, Bennett, you know?
Marty, I struggle with possibly, you know, because it's like, it's too expensive. Every time I open it, I'm like, I need to have this book. I'll go to stores and they have it. It's an incredible book. We've gone an hour 20. Can we pick this up on Saturday? Is it possible? Can we continue this conversation?
If you're interested.
Of course I'm interested.
All right, sure.
Do you mind? That would be terrific because I do have to get back to work. But I No. It's okay. And honestly, this is fine. And I wanted to make time for this. But I feel like we haven't really talked about your contributions to the Tasham book, and I wanted to compare that to DC Vault, and also whatever else you've got coming up that you want to talk about. So I mean, you know, it could be as short or as long as we need it to be. But no, as always, I appreciate the tangents because I think this provides a lot of people with good in-depth information that they've never heard and a perspective that they're not used to. And I think it answers a lot of behind-the-scenes questions that I think people always have. So this is great.
Well, John, you're very kind, and I thank you for your interest. And, offline, we'll work out a time, and hopefully it'll be boring.
Terrific. So that's Marty Pascoe. Make sure you stick around later in the weeks to come on Word Balloon. We will be presenting part two. Marty and I just have to get together and record it, but don't worry, it's coming. Before we finish off, I wanted to acknowledge a Kickstarter project from Mark Andrew Smith. His New Brighton Archaeological Society book, the first volume, was a critical success. He is moving on to volume two, and he's asking for help. There is a Kickstarter campaign for it. So if you go to Kickstarter.com, look up New Brighton Archaeological Society. There's just over 2 weeks left to go. It would be great if you can help him out. And also, make sure you support some of Mark's other projects, including Gladstone School for World Conquerors. That's the new book that just started a week ago. And it's a slightly older age group, but still we're talking about teenagers. They're learning how to be supervillains. So New Brighton is all about the young adventurers, and it's a great book for kids. And Gladstone's, I would say as well, is a great age-appropriate book to give to kids, and it's a very cute story about teenagers learning how to be supervillains. So check that stuff out from Mark Andrew Smith, a very good creator, The Amazing Joy Buzzards, among his fine books in the past, and we're looking forward to more work from Mark in the future. So that'll do it for Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you to hit all the usual stops for Word Balloon. Of course, ifanboy.com. You'll find a new episode weekly. Come to our website, wordballoon.com, and find our full archive of hundreds of interviews with artists and writers in the comics, animation, film, television, you name it, all waiting for you at wordballoon.com. Questions or comments about the show, feel free to reach me by email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me at Twitter under my name, John Wordballoon, or at Facebook under my name, John Suntress. How about that? Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2011.